This week's episode is a conversation about the encroaching financial architecture of the legacy financial and banking system and how Bitcoin presents a critical path forward for people to imagine a future where basic rights, including the right to transact and have financial independence and privacy, are protected. Our guest is Christian Ander, who is the CEO of Swedish Bitcoin exchange Qubit. And he has joined us to share his thoughts on what is happening in Europe and around the world, having been in this business for over 10 years. I'm Scott Dietels. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about how Bitcoin's unstoppable nature is intrinsic freedom technology, stick around. This is an important episode. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. We're joined this week by our special guest from Sweden, Christian Ander, CEO of Qubit. Christian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for hosting me.
Interested to hear your perspectives on what's happening on the other side of the pond. Maybe before we start our conversation today for our listeners, could we just get a quick overview? You've been involved in the Bitcoin space for a long time. And how did we get here?
Good question. Yeah, so basically I found Bitcoin by an accident almost 13 years ago. 2011. And for me, I was always been interested in open source, building stuff. I'm not a developer per se, but I like to do some coding. And I went to this free open source meetup, and suddenly I was talking to a guy. I still don't know who this is, but he orange-pilled me in 15 minutes back in 2011. So he definitely did something really good. And yeah, maybe I was really open for it. I don't know. But I'm a tech guy and I like the idea with open source money. So I probably was like quite easy to say. But from there, I started mining the very same night, actually, on my laptop. So it wasn't much, but it was still the start of my journey. And from there, my background, I'm an academic, studied quantum physics, had nothing to do with finance or economy or money. I was kind of still a student. I was a PhD student, so I didn't have a real job, if I can say that, but still in the academics. So embarking on my Bitcoin journey, I learned a lot about money, and I still today learn a lot about money, and it's every day I learn something new about money. I am still very grateful for that I found Bitcoin. It's like, oh shit, it's, yeah, whatever it is about money. And I'm so happy. We have Bitcoin.
So you and I met in the spring, leaving the Atlantis conference in Madeira, Portugal. And I was fascinated to hear just a short summary of your story of what you're going through right now. So you're operating an exchange in Sweden. And your company doesn't have a bank account in Sweden.
Correct. So to circle in with the story I just shared, I started an exchange, BTCX, 1 year later in 2012. And just as an experiment, like, okay, do people really want to buy Bitcoin in Sweden? I mean, I did buy Bitcoin back in the days from Mt. Gox in Japan. And it was quite a hassle. It was slow and expensive. And I was like, okay, I can help out here. And from there, I just, opened a bank account, onboarded customers, starting selling Bitcoin. And that's exactly what we do today. But during these 13, 12 years for the company, I noticed that the banks didn't really like Bitcoin. And that's not a news for anyone today in the Bitcoin space, but in Sweden, it's particularly difficult. Currently, there's just one company in Sweden that has a bank account and is working with Bitcoin. And just so you get the magnitude of it, it's I know another company who are doing tax software to efficient your tax filing. And they added Bitcoin to their platform and they lost their bank account for doing that. And it's like, come on, they're not even touching Bitcoin. They're just helping people to pay taxes. And that's Sweden. And it's funny because I've been thinking of this. Why is it that Sweden stands out as being so Bitcoin hostile. And I talked to a lot of people around the world. I'm not sure if this is true, but the story goes something like this. There's a family in Sweden called Wallenberg. They've been around for many, many years. They own the biggest bank, which my company actually had a bank account with for many, many years until a few years back. And this family, they kind of control the financial sphere in Sweden. They're engaged in businesses, you know, big businesses, even military and defense business. And now is where I haven't checked the fact, but they were part of starting the Federal Reserve in America back in the days. And that's also interesting. Okay, so they're part of the Bilderberg Group, this is fact, which have a huge network of influential people taking decisions. And so I started thinking, okay, so this family, they kind of run the scene in Sweden. There's just four, five major banks in Sweden, so it's not very competitive. And the authority regulating the banks, they are actually also working together with the banks, because if you want to work with the financial authority, you start in school, obviously, studying law or finance, and then you start working at the authority, and your next step is working at a bank. So when you sit at this authority, you want to have a good CV so you can get hired by the bank. And if you're not following what the agenda of the banks are proposing, you will not get a work. So they're very tightly connected. So it's not really working as it should be.
It works that way with the media in Canada.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's also funny because the media in Sweden is also one family owning most of the media. So it's kind of, you know, very dense. But the story doesn't end there. I just want to leap forward. And we also have the oldest central bank in the world in Sweden, still operating. It started in the 1600s. And apparently, the ancestor of this family, Wallenberg, also started that central bank. So I was like, holy shit, here in Sweden, small little freedom country, you know, with lakes and forests and stuff. Like, oh, we're kind of maybe the oldest running family of the central bank, I don't know, dynasty, how to say it. Okay, this might sound very crazy, but like, okay, maybe that's why they really hate it. I don't know. But here I am running in a Bitcoin exchange in Sweden. We don't have a bank account. It's still like we're fighting the longest family lineage of central bankers. Here I am.
Yeah, it's an amazing, you know, business complication to even have to comprehend. And actually, our episode one of the show was with a Canadian sort of counterpart of yours, Adam O'Brien, who we, you know, in that episode, we talked about a very similar thing where the banking industry in Canada is also similarly consolidated. And there is a lot of debanking happening here, just probably not quite to the extent where you have had to go actually outside of your borders just to function as a business financially.
Yes. So today we have a bank account in England and we have another one in Liechtenstein. And even our fellow country neighbor, Norway, we have an account with. So all our transaction is, you know, routed through outside of Sweden and then it comes back to Sweden. It's a big hassle. It's friction, and we're doing what we can to help our customers to have as a good journey anyway. And on the good side is what's happening now with the EU. I really don't like the EU. Like, it's like regulatory volcano spits out new regulations every day. But sometimes they actually is for our favor. And they have this payment initiative stating that payment service provider or payment initiation providers, they cannot be, what's the English word, in discrimination with the banks. So now we have a few payment service providers who want to work with us and the banks cannot stop them. So we're, as we speak, we're getting ready to launch this new payment rails in Sweden. And it's thanks for EU, for it due when credit is due, but otherwise, yeah, so it's going forward.
Yeah, there's an interesting, you know, like it's an intersection of, it's not just a business's ability to do business, but it is also the sort of free citizens of that country's ability to spend their money how they want to spend it. And so, you know, this kind of, yeah, it's a crossover point of a few different issues where I think impacting people's ability to have sort of autonomy over what they do with their money is in itself a very problematic thing that is maybe getting swept into some kind of like larger argument that, you know, Bitcoin is for something else or businesses that sell Bitcoin are doing something else. And you recently retweeted an article from Cointelegraph talking about the Swedish government considers crypto exchanges to be essentially just for money laundering.
Yeah. Yes. And that's the financial authority who is supervising us and also the banks. And they're having a very hostile approach to Bitcoin, which is definitely, in one way, it might even be illegal for them to have this approach to certain Bitcoin, but they also have the right to write reports like this. But it's also very interesting because the general director of financial inspection, or actually the last one, he tried to ban Bitcoin mining. Bitcoin mining is actually very big in Sweden because we have cheap renewable hydro energy in the Nordics. So sometimes the price is negative. I mean, really cheap. So you actually get paid to consume energy. And Bitcoin miners love this, of course. Imagine being a Bitcoin miner, you get both fiat money and Bitcoins. and the surplus of the heat you get from the miners, you could sell to a nearby city. And they pay a lot for that. So it's very profitable. And the general tried to ban Bitcoin mining in Sweden. So he flew down with his, of course, not very environmental friendly airplanes, private jet, to Brussels to try to ban it. And fortunately, he failed. But he was also very in the organization. He kind of made the organization, the financial supervisor, very hostile to Bitcoin as well. So when MiCA regulation, the European crypto regulation, came along, they appointed a Bitcoin skeptic to implement the EU legislation in Sweden. So it's like, oh man, come on. It's like, and what even more funny, after that, he got to be the general of the Central Bank of Sweden. So it's a very small pond, Sweden. So it's, yeah, that's how it is.
Yeah, it's amazing how you see the difference of, you know, we're still very much in the early days, but there was a recent announcement that Bhutan has been mining as a country and essentially have probably already mined a Bitcoin stash that could change the entire future of that country forever. El Salvador is mining and, you know, in the province of Canada that I live in, it's essentially impossible to get an electrical hookup to mine for new Bitcoin miners. And we're the same. We have an abundant hydro. There's plenty of capacity. Cold places and cold places in general should be thinking about Bitcoin mining for the multiple, as you mentioned, you know, there's multiple positive outcomes for large scale Bitcoin mining in cold places. It's crazy.
Yeah, definitely. It should be definitely. And also in every household in Sweden, you know, you have to heat your house, right? It's not that common. You have like a normal convection radiator, meaning that you just plug in electricity and you get heat. People do have that in Sweden, but it's not that common. Usually in Sweden, you have a heat pump, which basically it's like an air condition, but in reverse. So you get the warm heat and you put in 1 kilowatt hour of energy and you get 4 kilowatt hours. All the heat. So basically you get 4 times the more heat. But the process in that heat pump to warm, it's a gas which is going through different physical states. You could have a Bitcoin miner. So basically every household in Sweden could mine Bitcoin because they're spending the energy anyway. So it doesn't impact the energy consumption of the country, actually zero. It will just be a bonus. So whatever, you know, you still need to have those cheap ASIC chips. I don't know what they cost, but they shouldn't be that expensive. But I have no idea, actually. But I think that could be a huge profitable business, you know, upgrading your heating system with a Bitcoin miner, and boom, instantly you have heat, you have no effect on the energy bill, and you just have a Bitcoin miner. And you also may help out secure the Bitcoin network. So I guess for us, it's a no-brainer, but idea to market.
Yeah, there's a spa somewhere. It might be in Canada that uses Bitcoin mining to heat their hot pools.
Awesome. I have to go there.
Yeah. 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 The future of relaxation. I mean, it's such an interesting time. I see, and there was another news story this week about I believe it was in Belgium, BitSaga had also been debanked. And you see at different levels of increasing financial surveillance in Europe, talks about lowering the maximum allowable cash transaction in different countries. I think it's 500 euros in Greece and maybe 1,000 in France. And obviously as inflation continues to devalue money, you know, even 500 euros today might still be enough to buy something significant, but in 5 years or in 10 years, this is going to be like a haircut, right? It's
Definitely. This is a global problem. It's not in only EU, it's America and I guess Canada. I'm not sure how it looks there, but I guess it's coming there. It's not already there. And it's the FATF. I don't know the abbreviation of that, but it's a financial task force, something.
Financial Action Task Force, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yes. Actually, we hired a senior person from that task force to our company. He changed side a year ago. So it's like, yeah. And that's the pro thing. More and more people are, you know, changing side when they realize like, oh shit, where's this ending? Oh, it's going to total fascist in a way. And they realize that that's not the side they want to be in. And then some of them come to Bitcoin. So to our company. But yeah, the financial oversight and privacy. We also have the Telegram CEO story arrest and whatever happened there. And this is definitely one of the key aspects I'm trying to communicate to many people in Sweden and also in Europe that privacy is not only important. It's actually life and death in some cases, especially if you look at the geopolitical scene we're entering now with more wars and more tension and polarization everywhere in the world. Privacy is super important. I mean, who knows if some of your normal, you know, personal information comes out and some state or just a terrorist or an idiot gets that information and wants to do something bad with you. And that's why privacy is on a life and death matter. And the thing, which is also quite the opposite with Bitcoin and what media is reporting, is the old, I want to call it a lie, the old lie that Bitcoin is anonymous, which is not. And as a regulated Bitcoin company, we use these tools to analyze the blockchain. If we have a customer, we need to check, okay, where does this Bitcoin come from? But also where does the Bitcoin goes after they have been bought at our exchange. So we kind of realize that, okay, the biggest problem with Bitcoin is not anonymous. That is an anonymous chip. Anonymous. It's the opposite. It's transparent, which makes it very easy for anyone to see what are people actually doing on the blockchain. And I have personally a very good example of this when I was transferring Bitcoin from one wallet to another. And a few months later, I got a letter from the authorities like, oh, hey, we saw you make a Bitcoin transaction. Was this a sale? Did you sell your Bitcoin? And they wanted to have like my receipt, sales receipt and have taxes. I was like, holy shit, they're monitoring my wallets. I was like, Jesus Christ. So in BTCX, which is the Bitcoin exchange I started, we have started the work to implement a higher level of privacy. For example, the Bitcoin wallet address, as soon as we're done with it, we just erase it, or at least encrypt it, one-way encryption. And being a financial company, it's always difficult because you have to comply with storage of information and customer KYC, etc., anti-money laundering laws. So we're about to release an update where we can minimize the KYC data we have of you and also the Bitcoin address you use. So in that case, even if someone, God forbid, would hack our database, or if a government comes along, or if another kind of illicit actor try to extract information from our company, it's not there. It's like, it's the best privacy technique you can have. It's not even to have the information. And we're also very inspired from Wasabi. Unfortunately, they kind of merged into something else, or had to protect themselves from the government. I'm not sure on the details there, but we're working with them to also find a solution for privacy.
Yeah, I think for people who don't understand the significance of the kind of like battle that's being fought on this territory, there are some very smart and motivated people today dedicating their efforts to ensuring there will be some privacy in the future. You know, I think you made a great point earlier, and I couldn't agree more. You know, this often I hear, and I heard this a lot in 2020 about, you know, privacy is only for people who have something to hide. And I just couldn't disagree more, right? It's just, privacy is a fundamental right. And, you know, we should feel that we have, you know, we all have this. Yeah. It's something that everybody is entitled to some degree. And it doesn't at all imply that you're doing anything wrong. Another point you made, which I think is a good one, you know, the idea that Bitcoin is anonymous, which is not true. It's very easy to track. I personally feel that the use case that should be more appealing for people is that it's unstoppable money. It's not about hiding the money. It's a technology that enables you certainty that you will be able to transact that money however you want, because it is essentially impossible to prevent Bitcoin from being sent to one address to another. And to me, that is the thing, because as these things like anti-money laundering and cash transaction limits become more restrictive over time, these are getting back to the start of the conversation, right? These are the choke points that are available to the banks that are 400 years old, and they're going to naturally try to preserve their control as the technology sort of wrests away from them. And really, you know, I think this is a critical thing for people to understand about Bitcoin as a technological innovation, is that it has freed money from having to move through centralized points. And in that way, it becomes impossible to prevent from it being moved around.
It's an excellent point you're making. Unstoppable money. I really like that. And that's also how I started back in 2011 and 12. I read my mission statement a few months ago when I was updating a document. And for me, it's like the mission statement, which still is valid, it's like financial empowerment. We want to empower people to be financially free. And to become financially free, you need to have money that is free. Otherwise, you're always dependent on someone else. And that's the definition of being free. And the government is actually making a very good PR push for Bitcoin in that way, because every day it's getting harder to make transactions. It's getting more controls, more questions, and more people are getting pissed off with the financial system. And like, ta-da, and here we have Bitcoin. So the more they're pushing this, I mean, it's ridiculous, the amount of anti-money laundering procedures and laws we have today. I mean, it's ridiculous. And what is more is there is no scientific proof that it's actually working.
Yeah, anti-money laundering has nothing to do with catching criminals and everything to do with surveilling ordinary people, right? Because they know where the criminals are. You know, this is
it's so stupid. So it's just, I don't know, it's like it's just for one thing, and it's controlling normal people. It's not for stopping crime. And yeah, it's
Like,
I don't know. I would actually not know what I would be doing today if not Bitcoin were around. I would probably join like an Amish society somewhere. Like, okay, fuck this. I'm growing my own food in the forest without any technology. But fortunately, we have Bitcoin today, so it's a really good tool.
Yeah, it's the best tool, you know. And I think like for most people, the average person really just wants to, you know, enjoy their life, be a part of society, and you know, as part of that, it does involve, you know, having some privacy and the freedom to spend your money the way that you want to spend it. You've earned it, and you've paid taxes on it after that, and like. Beyond that, if you're not doing anything illegal, that's kind of where it should end, right? You know, in my mind.
Definitely. And that also comes back to the social contract, which also, if you go back, I don't know the date, but let's say a few hundred years before tax, like what was the main point of paying taxes? It was to protect your field from being robbed or burned or pillaged. So you paid the king to have some knights protecting you. It was a really simple agreement, like, here, you have some of our food, and we get some of your protection. And today, the tax system, it's so far away from the original purpose. I just tweeted today, like, oh, tax is theft. It shouldn't be theft, but today it's more or less theft, because it's not doing the purpose as it should be. And after Russia invaded Ukraine, you could also read headlines that Germany, which is the driving economy force in Europe, was going to invest, I think it was 1,000 billion euro in defense costs. I mean, insane. Like, okay, that it's like, okay, yeah, tax should go to defense. But that amount of money, you don't have a say. You don't negotiate, like, okay, it's insane. And basically, that will also go to fund a war, probably.
Yeah, and not only that, but the creation of that money is an arbitrary dilution of the money you've already earned. And, you know, it is a sort of secondary, a discrete form of taxation by devaluing the money that everyone else already has to create that spending. You know, it's like there are two sort of it's the normalization of creeping tax, and taxes also, not only did they were introduced, but then they forever grow into a bigger and bigger part. And this is just sort of an accepted thing. And the other accepted thing is this idea of inflation target. And there was another European announcement today about Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank, feels pretty good that 2025, they'll be getting back to the 2% inflation target, which is, you know, their way of broadcasting to people that, you know, when we do our job, your money will only be, you know, worth 2% less next year instead of 10, or, you know, when we do a really bad job. And this is kind of, these are just accepted things. Yeah. You know, I have a quote from David Bradley, who's, a good friend and has been on the show, and he tweeted this the other day. He said, "For the first time in history, information technology allows for the creation and protection of assets that lie entirely outside the realm of any individual government's territorial monopoly on violence." One of the other really weird things, and this totally gets to your comment about social contract, which is what I was thinking about, that is the state absolutely does have a legal monopoly on violence, which they apply however they see fit, regardless of, you know, we get to vote however regularly it is in the country you live in. And then after that, it's done. And if they decide to wage international violence and devalue your money to do it, that is something that really no one has any say in. So this idea of having a money system that exists entirely outside of that, to me, is such an interesting way of rephrasing another critical part of Bitcoin's value proposition for people who, we're not going to be able to do anything about the federal government decisions, but you can sort of peacefully opt out by just choosing to not have your money sitting inside a system that is going to pay for that stuff.
Totally. And that's historically, I mean, we had the gold right? As a currency, or silver and copper. And in England back in the days, also when gold and copper and silver was used, and the king of England, was it King Richard? I'm not that good in history, but it could have been the Robin Hood king, if you know the Disney story. And he decided, oh yeah, I want to wage war with the French people because I don't like them for some reason and wanted something from them. So they diluted the coinage with something else. I mean, basically it's supposed to be pure, but the market reacted quite quickly and said, oh, the new coins from the king, oh, but they're not worth as much as the older coins. So you instantly got inflation with the new coins. So it's like when I say they, I mean like the king or the power who is making the laws and the money is always trying to dilute the currency. And now we have the fiat system. I mean, basically, we have the perfect fiat system. We have central banking, you know, digitalized with the banks operating for them. So it's kind of perfect that we actually get Bitcoin in this area. So we can easily opt out from that.
Yeah. The system is not broken. It's working to perfection. The system is designed to effortlessly create more and more money all the time and make your money worth less in doing so. It's a great gig. If you are the ones controlling banking and currencies, it's like, you know, it's never been easier.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, and the same thing happened with the US in 1933 when they needed to reestablish gold reserves. And so they confiscated gold and then sort of immediately repriced it. And so this has happened, you know, countless times through history, to your point about, yeah, this is an old trick.
It's a very old trick. I mean, falling for it every time. That's the funny thing. And what also think could, let's say, work better is the media. So the media's role, as I see it, should be to inform the public and to be critical about the government and makes us more aware of how we should vote in the next election, for example. And if you look at the media today, it's kind of the opposite. It's supporting the current narrative. And if you take America, you have the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, both of them they're basically the same in one way, because they're supporting, none of them will kick out central bank of the Federal Reserve. I mean, it's still, you know, the structure. So it makes everyone to believe they can do a change by voting on A or B. It's like, no. So, I mean, and it's same, of course, same in Sweden. We have two political parties, which are the bigger ones, and they've been around for 100 years. So, and it's always like left against right. And it's like, that's not what it's about. It's like, it's the system, or it's new ideas, or it's a political shift, or basically as a shift of power. Because the longer you have the same power, And now I'm saying it's the same power if you vote left or right, because they've been around for so long. It's the longer it runs, the more corrupt it becomes, because it's the power structure you find, you build, you know, loopholes for things to corrupt it, basically. So you need to shift it. Yeah, and that's the role that the media should take to really be a helpful hand in that part. But it's not. It's taking the other way. So it's not just that we have the perfect fiat system operating. We also have a very strong media supporting it. So then, from one thing about privacy and Bitcoin, we come to another, which is communication, the freedom of speech is also extremely important. And then luckily I haven't actually used it so much, but it seems like Nostr is a good tool for that. I'm really into Bitcoin and I understand this technology a lot, but I don't understand Nostr, but they say it's a good decentralized protocol for communication, which is extremely important as we go down the line of history as well.
Yeah, I think there's decentralization and the concept of, if you can understand the unstoppable nature of a Bitcoin transaction, and money is information technology, right? So you're sending information. And so I think that the extension of understanding the unstoppable, uncensorable sharing of information will inevitably lead to sort of a waterfall of innovation that has this idea embedded into all kinds of things. So to me, the core of it is being able to exchange value. Because if you can do that in an unstoppable way, then I can pay you to use your skills to create something, an idea. And the idea that Bitcoin, the unstoppable money, is the foundation for, I think it's a digital renaissance. I think we are headed for a totally new way of imagining society. And we'll see how we get there. Yeah, I've been thinking about this since the start of the episode. I'd love to, maybe before we move on, ask you a quantum physics question about Bitcoin, which is something I'm interested in quantum mechanics myself, and I wonder your opinion on what do you think that the consensus obsession with the Bitcoin price in fiat has to do with the price? Okay. This is like a double slit, Bitcoin's price and the double split experiment.
Yeah, well, of course it has. Of course it has. Yeah, I mean, my let's say non-quantum physics answer would be the obsession with price of any asset makes it go up higher and down lower. I mean, it just accelerate whatever trajectory it's going. From a quantum perspective, I'm not sure how to answer that. But I can say there are many aspects of Bitcoin I think is solid and unstoppable, and many problems people talk about. Oh, this is the biggest problem with Bitcoin. I personally think privacy is one of them. But another one is actually quantum encryption and quantum computers. I was doing my master's in quantum computing and was building a quantum algorithm, a very, very simple algorithm. I don't even remember what it was doing, but it was super simple. But the logic when you do with quantum computers is super different. So it's really hard to get into the mind space of thinking. I do prefer normal logical computers, but the power. I mean, we do have two encryptions, what they call them, algorithms in Bitcoin, the SHA-256 for mining, and then you have the elliptic curves for the private key. And I have to say, I'm not a quantum physicist, computer scientist, expert today. And but I can see that might be one of the things I'm a bit concerned about when quantum computers become too big and too powerful. They will crack any encryption we have. So it's not a Bitcoin problem. It's basically a digital problem. How could we send information with privacy? That's the problem. And then when the solution is, of course, quantum encryption. And the good thing with quantum encryption, it's unhackable, actually. Then you have, by the laws of physics, you cannot violate them as we understand today, at least. So that's the upside with quantum encryption. It guarantees 100% privacy. But the transition, how will that look when we go from a classical, let's call it, information age to a crypto? No, sorry, quantum information age. And how will Bitcoin leap through that journey? And I believe it will happen within the next 50 years. So it's definitely within the realm of the Bitcoin history. I will leave that to the listeners to solve.
Yeah, I don't know anything about quantum computing myself, other than a handful of things I've read. I did actually read, we're recording this on October 10th, there was Bitcoin Amsterdam has just happened, and there was a presentation at that conference with a proposal around how to integrate a solution on top of elliptical curve to quantum proof the Bitcoin. The concern is that the public keys will be cracked, right? Yeah. So, without getting too far in the weeds, my hope is just in the same way that we've been talking about over the entire conversation, as new technologies emerge and new threats to privacy and freedom emerge, there will be people who have the desire and the talent and the know-how to use those same innovations to create new solutions. And Bitcoin really is this beautiful sort of living organism that, because of its open source nature, it's a problem that people anywhere in the world can have a look at, have a think about, contribute to if they want to try. And that on its own is a pretty interesting and maybe sort of quantum idea in itself, as we all stare at this thing and it becomes something different as a result of us paying attention to it.
Indeed, so very beautiful put. And I would say in that aspect, it's basically the hope of humanity. Where for the future of Bitcoin, we can hope that people will still be fighting for freedom and privacy. Our children will still have the drive to build a thriving society where we can be free. And freedom it's not a state we achieve. It's like an infinite war, if you want to call it, or infinite aspiration we every generation need to aspire for the freedom and truth to win. And currently, I would say Bitcoin is the path today. But in 50 years, it might be something else, or we don't know. But it's the aspiration that we humans continue to thrive like this. We have to trust them.
That's very well said. Maybe we'll wrap there, Christian. This has been a very interesting and insightful conversation. I want to thank you for coming on. For our listeners who maybe would like to find more of you online, is there anywhere we should point them directly?
The most easiest is our webpage, bt.cx. It's our exchange, but you can always find me there. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter, Christian Ander, and find me there. So whatever, wherever you choose.
And we will include those links in the show notes, of course. And so thank you again. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the show, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and hope to see you again next week.
Cheers, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.